This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. U.S. unemployment rate down below 4%, wages jumping last month, adding to evidence of a tight labor market that really is expected to help spur the Fed interest rate liftoff as soon as March, despite disappointing payroll growth. But if you look at some of the research from Carl and others, that there was some interesting way things were calculated and maybe some seasonal variations versus non-seasonal or whatever. And so maybe it wasn't as negative as everybody
Yeah,
as
that headline
was reported.
Number. Yeah. That headline number, that's another woof, 199 versus an estimate of 450,000. Let's get into it with Becky Frankiewicz, president at Manpower Group North America. She joins us once again on the phone from Chicago. Becky, do you agree with Carl Riccadonna, who we spoke to earlier in the day, that overall this is a very positive jobs report?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, there's been a lot of talk today, Tim, about calculations and self-employment. Is that what's making the difference between household and the broader employer report? And I would say, you know, 2022 is not only a new year, you know, it's a new horizon for the American labor market. And I would calculate today's report as disappointing, but not because of demand, Tim. We know that demand for workers remains very high, 11 million open jobs in December, yet we can also see this demand is not translating to positions filled, and that's the part that's disappointing to me. So we have a booming economy in terms of demand, and we don't have enough workers coming off the sidelines. And the one thing I was watching today is participation, and you saw it really didn't move.
So go ahead, Carol.
Well, why do you think that's happening? I mean, Tim and I have had lots of conversations. Our whole team has. I've certainly seen it, members of my family or people I know anecdotally, either folks who are near retirement who said, I'm done, I'm good, for different reasons. Others saying, you know what, my husband and I have been working like mad people, never get to see our family. The pandemic showed us that. We're going to figure out how to do it either on one salary or I'm going to do a job closer to my home so I can be with my family more. And maybe I'll give up a vacation or buying some stuff.
Yeah, Carol, so it's all of that. It's definitely early retirements. You know, we saw about 1.5 million people retire early, on average 3 years earlier than expected. You know, I would propose that we'll see those come back into the workforce. Not yet, but I think they'll go and take a few vacations and decide they're young enough to want to have something additionally to do. We definitely are seeing, you know, two-income earner families shift to one income or 1.5 incomes, people working part-time. So the pandemic has changed us. It's changed us. And, you know, as I talk to employers across the country, you know, the new year, people want to talk about new beginnings. And I've been coaching to talk more around new endings. You know, what are we seeing end as we go into this new era? And I tell you, we're seeing the end of minimum wage as the anchor of labor value. So there's, you know, there's a required rate wage that to attract people into the workforce. And that's what we have to talk about.
And about time, right? I mean, if you think
about time,
right, the individuals who, I mean, we have these conversations too, right, Tim? I mean, how do you support a family of four or one or two with minimum wage in parts of the country? I don't know how people do it.
Yeah, look,
well,
what does
minimum even mean anymore? Right. I mean, it really is. And the great news is
a living wage, right?
And today it's not even living. I mean, it's required. You know, what's required both for white collar, which, you know, we've seen, but now blue collar, we're seeing, you know, in some cases 20-30% increase in blue collar jobs for wages. And that is encouraging to see that kind of wage growth across both the spectrums of the economy.
But still not enough wage growth to get those people off the sidelines, Becky. What is it going to take to get them to participate in the labor force?
So it's not enough to get them off the sideline, but it's definitely enough to get them to change jobs, as we saw records in the quit rate also happen towards the end of the year. But it's going to, you know, compensation is table stakes. Wages is table stakes, Tim. So now we have to look at things like flexibility, and not just flexibility for the knowledge workers, flexibility for the blue-collar workers as well, and what that looks like in more of a factory or manufacturing environment. You know, people understand that their skills are changing quickly, or demand for skills is changing. They want just-in-time training. And so it really is a holistic approach to employment versus wages as a standalone.
So what jobs in particular, though, are you seeing tons of demand for?
Yeah, so we're seeing hospitality come back, and you saw that in the report today. You know, not back to where we were. We shouldn't say that gap is anywhere near closed, but coming back. We continue to see growth in the IT space, particularly as we, you know, people go back and forth between, are we going back to the office or even 2 days a week? Are we not coming back at all, which requires a lot of support. And the medical field continues to be robust. A lot of the jobs that we saw, you know, during the pandemic that were decimated, they're coming back. But we're also seeing this new, you know, a new market, a new standard for jobs that were created, like ops and logistics, as we all shop from home. Those continue to grow in demand. And the most interesting one, Carol, that we're seeing is HR roles. So in 2020, HR roles were not even big enough. They were classified in other in terms of open jobs. They're now separated out 2% of all open roles as companies struggle to try to answer the question, exactly what we're talking about is, how am I going to get people to come off the sidelines? How am I going to keep the employees I have and go find new employees to backfill them where I have, you know, absenteeism hitting record highs due to COVID?
Yeah, HR, I've said this a million times, but after the financial crisis, I felt like we all looked at the CFO very differently because they were strategic in getting companies through the financial crisis. HR individuals and their teams have been strategic, Tim, in getting everybody through COVID.
Yeah, they really have. Hey, Becky, we have you for just a little bit more time, 30 seconds. What is the definition of full employment? How should we think about the definition of full employment in January 2022?
Yes, I would tell you that's outdated language, Tim. We have to think about now getting the labor force participation rate up. Mm. That's what matters, not full employment. You know, wages are moving. We have to bring more people into the workforce, and it's all about participation.
Okay.
Right, because you do think about if we can't get everybody, if employers can't get folks back into work, what does it mean for their ability to be productive, productivity,
right?
And then that will play out in earnings, and we're going to start seeing earnings next week. Becky, stay well. Happy New Year. Good to check in with you. Becky Frankowitz, she's president over at Manpower Group North America, on the phone from Chicago. It's different this time around. Can I
it
even
is.
Say that?
Yeah, I think you can.
All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Tim and Carol, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, carrot or stick, Citi definitely pulling out the stick today, becoming the first major Wall Street bank to impose a strict COVID-19 vaccine mandate. Man, they are getting tough.
Jenny Serain has the exclusive. She's finance reporter with Bloomberg News. She's on the phone with us from New York City. Jenny, workers at Citi who don't comply by January 14th to get a shot, what happens?
Yeah, so the mandate actually allows folks to apply for religious or medical exemptions. So I think that is an important thing to note with all of this. But yeah, if you don't either apply for that exemption or get the shot itself, then you'll be placed on the unpaid leave. And at the end of the month, they will fire you. So definitely a pretty strong message and something they've been telegraphing since October, you know, trying to get anybody who was hesitant on board, but definitely, you know, taking steps to kind of carry out what it said it would.
Well, you know, and it's interesting. There's a lot going on right now. The U.S. Supreme Court set to hear arguments right today on a Biden administration order for large employers to require vaccinations or weekly COVID tests, meaning more mandates could be coming if the rules proceed. I mean, we're seeing information from the government, mandates come from the government, and companies are probably looking to kind of take steps to potentially comply with maybe possibly what's coming at this point. I am curious how... I don't know how much you can tell us. How did you find out about this story? Was it somebody who wasn't vaccinated? Somebody who was vaccinated?
I think definitely it's interesting that some, you know, a handful of employees have decided to speak out and go public with their consternation.
Are they vaccinated or not?
I think so.
Yeah, okay, forget it.
I mean, I think a lot of folks are, it's a very divisive issue.
Yeah.
So Citi has bankers in Manhattan where vaccine hesitancy isn't that high or isn't that, you know, big of an issue. But they have folks in Missouri. They have folks in Kentucky. They have folks in Florida, Texas.
Right.
Like, it's a very hard to have a one-size-fits-all policy. And so you kind of see what that, you know, what has to end up coming with that when you, you know, make a mandate for 70,000 people in many, many states across the country. So it's definitely not something that everyone agreed with. And I think the company has tried its best to do different programs and do lots of education. They've brought in doctors. They've, you know, held lots of hands. But I do think it was interesting that, you know, the handful that did kind of spilled out into the public and decided to go this route.
I do wonder too, though, what about like if they have client meetings, are they going to say, I'm not going to take a meeting with you if you aren't vaccinated? Like, I wonder how widespread something like this goes through a company.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think Certainly in places like New York where, you know, you'd kind of think about bankers flying out to meet clients, it's a much easier mandate to make. But in places like Florida and Texas where you have the governors coming on and saying, no, your company isn't allowed to mandate that you have a vaccine, I think that's a very different type of messaging that, you know, bankers or employees are getting from both their company and their state government. So I think that was kind of the point of the story, was just to show it's, you know, it's not an easy path. And still they've at more than 90% compliance, is a figure that's rapidly rising.
So what does this mean for other banks, Jenny?
Well, I think a lot of what other folks are thinking through is hinging on what the Supreme Court decides. So they, you know, started to hear opening arguments today. OSHA has said it will start enforcing starting next week. So I think we're really at this kind of crazy time for HR professionals and these return to office people, where they have to start making a call. Are they going to mandate the vaccine? Are they going to implement weekly testing requirements? Are they going to, you know, bring back masks to even sitting at your desk? Like, they really have to make some of these tough calls, because pretty soon they'll start getting, you know, OSHA will start finding them if they don't. So this is just the beginning. I think we're going to see a lot more of this from a lot of different companies. And for those companies like Citi that have folks all over the country, it's not an easy path.
Yeah, I do. It'll be interesting next week. As you said, we're going to be hearing from all of the big banks and see what they have to say about certainly COVID and some of their policies following on this Citi news. Jenny, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Jenny Serain, finance reporter at Bloomberg News, on the phone in New York City. Her story, it is the most read on the Bloomberg terminal in the past 8 hours. But again, you're seeing companies at this point, here we are, what, in our third year, taking policies and taking steps to you know, be able to really open up their companies.
I anticipate we're going to see more of this, not just from banks, but from other big companies. And I also think that boosters are going to be a big part of this too. How are companies going to incorporate boosters into their policies?
And I feel like I'm going to get ready for a fourth booster, right? Whether it's in 6 months or it's just
Israel's already doing it.
Exactly.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week is out. It's got a great cover on it to match a great cover story on pop star Jessica Simpson. Let's get into the issue, though, now with the magazine editor. We're talking about Jill Weber on the Access line in Brooklyn. I do love the cover image, too.
I do, too. I'm holding it up in my hands right now on the cover, how Jessica Simpson bought her name back. When your billion-dollar empire implodes, you get a loan, go to bankruptcy court, and start over. It does bury the lead, Joel, that this battle really hit a high point when she was giving birth.
Yeah, the story opens just an incredibly memorable scene as she's watched this billion-dollar fashion empire that she basically lent her name to, a licensing deal, and it's basically falling apart on her right as you know, she's giving birth in the middle of the pandemic, no less. And so, you know, from there, it's just an utterly gripping beginning of the story about how she, you know, has clawed back a story that I think is a really memorable one. And her business is just getting going with her in charge of it. But it's sort of this amazing thing of, like, you know, normal people, like, you know, maybe the three of us, I've never thought about losing my name, but, like, that is something that somebody like a Jessica Simpson might have to worry about. And what do you get to do once you get it back and have a business that has your name on it again?
Well, and that's what's interesting about this story. I feel like it's a primer, Joel, in many ways, about licensing, right? And celebrities, I guess sometimes we think, oh, they're so in control of their businesses, but so many often license their name out on an array of products, which is the case in what she did. Sometimes it goes really well. Sometimes it doesn't.
And that's right. I mean, for her, it actually did go incredibly well for a while. And, it, you know, it's like, if there's a lesson within the lesson here, it's like, you know, choose your partners wisely. And she did do that. She absolutely did. Except that when the first one passed away, it basically set off this domino effect that, you know, she was on the outside looking in. And that's what led her to have to go to bankruptcy court and, like, reassert herself.
So without giving too much away about the cover story, what's next for Jessica Simpson?
Well, I think she has to actually, like, run a business. And, you know, that's in and of itself is going to be challenging. But the fact that her mom, Tina, is very involved and has been for a very long time, actually, that, you know, the two of them basically get to recreate that empire. And we can, you know, if everything goes well, you can see how successful it can be from its previous iterations.
Yeah. And I just love all the players that are in the story that really explain how she got to where she was initially. And then those that help bring her down. Let's get to a story that really has stayed with us throughout the week. I know we talked with you about this. COVID reversing 25 years of progress for the world's girls. Where you guys take us, as you in the magazine always so well do, to developing worlds and tell very personal stories of what's happening with women around the world.
Yeah, this is an incredible story that we call the Lost Girls of COVID. And to me, one of the things that has stuck with me about this story is this idea that, look, we're, you know, 2 years into this pandemic now, and we've been talking about the head-on consequences for a really long time of just what COVID does to your body and what obviously it's done to society. But there are these other hidden things that I think we're only beginning to appreciate. And that was the case with this story, which is, you know, over the last 25 years and change, we have just seen girls around the world have an amazing ascent. The progress that they've experienced from health to education, it has dramatically put them into positions that they wouldn't have otherwise been in. And that has brought great good to the world. And we've seen economic growth because of that. And this is especially true in the developing world, like you mentioned, Carol. But what COVID has done is actually erased a lot of that progress. And that's where that story goes.
So, again, I'm trying to look forward here and understand how we avoid a situation where it takes 25 years to get girls in the developing world back to where they were in 2020. What do policymakers need to do? What do governments need to do? What do nonprofits and NGOs need to do? How does that happen?
Well, I think we just start by talking about it and acknowledging what a problem it is, and that if we're not aware of it, then a lot of these girls are going to suffer in silence. And like, you know, the main thing was one of the main things in the story, and which largely is centered in Kenya, right? Is this idea around teenage pregnancies, right? That the moment that a girl has to start caring for a child, it basically derails what other progress was being made. But that is not like an insurmountable hurdle, you know, but it does mean that policymakers need to be able to support young mothers with the resources that can help them succeed too. So that strikes me as like one place that can go, but boy, there's a lot of others. And as long as we're not blind to it, and that was sort of our goal with the story, was just to be talking about what a significant challenge awaits these women.
Yeah, substantial setbacks for these girls in the developing world. Not apples to apples, Joel, but certainly another story that deals with setback potentially for women. And this has to be kind of the aftermath of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. Like, what have we learned? And you actually asked that of Ashley Vance.
Yeah, when the headline crossed my email that the jury had reached a verdict and had found Holmes guilty on several counts, I immediately just was like, Ashley, what does this mean? And, you know, it had stuck with me, especially just, you know, not that long ago, a couple months ago, we did that cover story about 23andMe, which very similar sort of story, right? You have a female founder in the biotech space, doing, you know, venture backed for a long time. Her story, the company becomes public. But it just struck me in working on that cover story how much of a challenge it must be to be a woman doing all that stuff and then have the Elizabeth Holmes narrative in the background. And Ashley and I were talking about that, and he said, you know what, don't, and this is what he writes in the story, don't read into that so much. You know, the Holmes story, the outcome is that fraud is fraud, you know, and at the end of the day, that's what a jury found, is like, so don't go thinking that there's some greater meaning to Elizabeth Holmes so much as like, you know, look, fraud is fraud, and this is America, and we have a legal system that thankfully can step in and expose that.
Well, Joel, just in the last 30 seconds that we have, either the pushback to that has been that, you know, Silicon Valley culture is fake it till you make it, right?
Yes, and that is totally true. And, you know, there will be the lesson of Theranos, which is Theranos was fraud, right? And that they had technology that was unproven. There's a lot of other really promising ones out there. And I got to say, look, bring it back to COVID. Who thought that we would have mRNA vaccines in the time frame that we've had them? Like, this has been an amazing accomplishment. And let's say that there's not going to be many more of those in biotech in the years to come.
All right. Joel Weber, thank you so much. Editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. Check out the new issue. It is on newsstands online at BloombergBusinessWeek.com. Also on the Bloomberg Terminal. Also a fun section about where to go in 2022. We talk about some of that with Chris Rouser on our weekend show. Catch that on Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Really looking forward to our next guest. He was a former software engineer at Airbnb, taught a class in cryptocurrencies, also a world-class professional poker player, has written a book about it, The Philosophy of Poker. And we're going to do our weekly check on cryptocurrencies. I feel like there's lots to talk about with him.
Haseeb Qureshi is managing director at Dragonfly Capital. $1.9 billion in assets under management. Haseeb, thanks so much for joining us on the program. You're joining us from San Francisco.
Thanks for having me.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. It's a little bit rainy day here in SF, but otherwise doing good.
Well, the data is still coming in for venture capital deals for 2021, but it looks like it's going to be another banner year when it comes to money that's raised, especially a banner year coming for new crypto and blockchain, NFT, metaverse startups. Give us an idea of what 2022 has in store.
So I think what you're probably going to see over 2022 is it's time to put up or shut up for a lot of the metaverse and gaming stuff. So what you're seeing right now, it's a very, very frothy market. We're seeing a lot of excitement around, to be honest, games that haven't really shipped products quite yet. The question is going to be largely, one, are we going to see traditional gaming studios getting into the space, and who is it going to be? Is it going to be the crypto native firms that build these kind of, you know, metaverse, NFT, gaming integrated universes, or is it going to be traditional gaming studios that work their way into crypto gaming and crypto-enabled gaming? And is that going to be where the lion's share of the market goes? Right now, I think everyone realizes that this is going to be a very important sector. The thing that no one knows is how it's going to play out and how long it's going to take for stuff to get realized.
Well, you know, it's funny because the second half of 2021, if we think about the metaverse and the conversation around the metaverse, I think a lot of the conversation has been dominated by Facebook's name change to Meta and them going all in on the metaverse. I'm wondering who you think are going to be the big winners when we think about the metaverse. Is Facebook going to be able to pull it off, or are startups going to be able to compete with Facebook?
It's funny because you know, the term metaverse has gotten so corrupted over the last year, I think largely as a result of Facebook getting into this and everyone kind of redefining what metaverse means for themselves. You know, originally the concept of the metaverse implied a digital space that allowed you to connect to many different universes simultaneously. And the entire idea of Facebook owning the metaverse is almost like the idea of Facebook being the internet, which is, you know, kind of, at this point, and for most of us, that's an absurd proposition. So to me, I think it's very clear that Facebook is going to create a very big digital space, and they're going to do everything they can to try to get as many of their users, especially on the younger side, to engage with the kind of social tools that Facebook is going to try to create. But, you know, at the end of the day, the concept of the metaverse is this concept that it's going to be an open, extensible platform that many different players are going to be contributing to, not just Facebook / Meta. And so I think in the short run, Facebook is going to be doing a lot to contribute to the infrastructure, the acceleration of augmented reality, and all these different technologies that we need for a metaverse-like interaction to be fully immersive. But in the long run, you know, I believe in decentralized movement. I believe in crypto. And part of what makes crypto so powerful is the fact that you have so many individual actors and companies contributing to make this overall tapestry of what crypto is. And I think in the long run, the metaverse is going to be the same way.
So I'm curious to talk to us a little bit about Dragonfly Capital, because from what I understand, you guys, you know, are allocating money, making investments in areas that you find interesting, particularly it feels like in the blockchain. But fill us in if you would.
Yeah, so Dragonfly, we're a global crypto fund. We have folks all over the world, in Asia, in the U.S., West Coast, East Coast. We kind of cover everything. We're very early-stage investors. Mm-hmm. We've been early investors into DeFi, into Layer 1 cryptocurrencies. You know, obviously, we're early investors into Bitcoin and Ether and kind of everything under the sun. Anything that's crypto, we touch it. So we're part of what makes us different is that we're very technology-oriented.
Yeah.
And we only do crypto. So we don't do kind of fintech adjacent plays or anything like that. Crypto is what we do from day one, and we've managed to become quite good at it.
Well, what are your anticipations? I'm curious how I feel like 2021 was a big year for cryptocurrencies. How do you see 2022? What might some interesting benchmarks that, Haseeb, you think we need to be focusing on?
It's a good question. I mean, clearly, you can see from the jitters that we've had over the last 36 hours is that the Fed has a lot to say about how crypto is going to evolve over the next year. And ultimately, crypto really rose to the forefront of everyone's attention last year. For a confluence of reasons, a lot of them accelerated by COVID, some of them monetary policy more generally. It's certainly the case that crypto was born in the wake of the great financial crisis, literally in the genesis block of Bitcoin, the very first block of Bitcoin that Satoshi mined. It says Chancellor on the brink of the bailout for the banks, which is a reference to the original bailout that was happening in the UK, where potentially Satoshi might have been paying attention to. And Bitcoin really came to the fore now in this financial crisis that emerged as a result of COVID. Now, the change in the policy of the Fed and other central banks around the world and the rising of interest rates is naturally going to have an effect on crypto, because crypto, for most of the institutional investors who've gotten into crypto over the last year, who've driven most of this market, they're very, very, the way that they view crypto is much like a growth asset.
Yeah.
And anytime that you're investing in a growth asset, you've seen growth assets really retrace over the last 6 months.
Right.
And I think you're likely to see the same thing happen to crypto if interest rates rise faster than otherwise expected. But in the long term, I think everyone at this point realizes crypto is here to stay. This is not a trend that's going to get reversed. This is not something you can put back into the box. There are some countries that are going to fight crypto.
Right.
But at the end of the day, this is a global phenomenon, and you're not going to be able to turn back the dial of history.
The conversation around it has certainly definitely evolved. Hopefully you'll come back and we can talk some more, because I've got to say, everybody, check out his website to understand a little bit more about Haseeb's personal path, because it's a really interesting one. Haseeb Qureshi over at Dragonfly Capital right here on Bloomberg.
Let's bring in Cliff Corso, President and Chief Investment Officer at Advisor Asset Management. Cliff joins us on the phone from New York City. Cliff, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Cliff, how should our audience digest everything that we've learned this week? As Carol mentioned, the S&P 500 closing at a record on Monday, a strong start to the year. We did get a little bit of a Santa Claus rally those first 2 days, but then the tone really shifted when we got those Fed meetings Wednesday, and then also digesting the jobs report today. How do we bring it all together?
Yeah, I think both of those things tie together nicely, because today's job report, where unemployment rate dropped to 3.9%, and very importantly, wages year over year increasing to 4.7%. Those are obviously very strong numbers, and it just puts more fuel in the fire of the debate over is the Fed beginning to fall behind the inflation curve, and what is the implication of that for rates as we move through time. And I think the punchline is that the emergency policy that the Fed is still generally operating under, That's long past its expiry date, and that became very clear today with the jobs report numbers.
One and done. Check the box. So, all right. So is it just a debate of whether does the Fed raise rates come March? Does it do it May? Is it just a matter of the particulars and the timing and how aggressive ultimately the Fed is going forward?
Yeah, I think it's maybe a little less about the exact timing and a little bit more about, are they falling behind the curve here on inflation? And, Fed's got a really tough job here. And a tough challenge, because I think that they really clearly want to speed up their reaction function, given inflation figures. We saw that with the pulling forward of the tapering. But they're trying to do this without creating undue volatility, like we saw during the taper tantrum of 2013. At the same time, trying to do it without damaging their own credibility into the peak of Omicron. So, if they're too slow, they risk falling behind the curve further and further. If they're too quick, the market's obviously fearful that we're not priced for that.
So connect this. Yeah, Cliff, connect this to 2022 and as far as what we should look at for asset allocation and how our audience should think about investing this year.
Sure. And the zero rate narrative has been such a big part of the return. And so I think what we're seeing in the market, and it's what we've believed for quite a while, is that it's with rates rising, which is our expectation. We think it is time for a leadership shift. We think GDP is going to still be solid and supportive of market positive market returns this year, but with a lot more volatility because of the uncertainty around rates and inflation.
Where do you think I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say we do think value will take the baton of leadership in growth and particularly low or no earning stocks. That's a really tough story. A narrative story in the rising rate environment.
Why do you think ultimately now is really the time for value? I mean, we've certainly had this discussion with a lot of folks over the last year or so about, okay, it's time for value, it's time for value. We talked about it when tech sold off back in March of 2021, just last year, right? An official 10% correction, yet it came roaring back. Why is now there's something different that it really is the time for value to come back?
Sure. Well, we've been in a very big sawtooth pattern around what's been going on with the variants and COVID. But I think the market is beginning to look through. You know, we don't know everything about where we're headed with this, but we do know a lot more, and we have a lot more tools. So as we move toward this pandemic sawtooth up and down unknown into perhaps endemic, we can get a little bit more predictable, perhaps, about, you know, where the economy is headed. And again, our view is somewhere between 3.5%, 4%. That's, you know, obviously that's very solid growth. We do think rates will rise, but our opinion is not so much that it would knock off the growth of the economy. And so you have a very supportive scenario. But as well, given the returns, rising rates, we think cash flow becomes a lot more important. So we're looking at dividend stocks, dividend payers. If rates are rising and you have no earnings or no cash flow, that's a very sensitive instrument to be owning in a rising rate environment. So we think it now is the time, again, with volatility, and we're not saying you can't see corrections, but we think by the end of the year you would see a positive result in the value sector.
Hey, I want to talk a little more about inflation because that's going to be on everyone's mind certainly next week. CPI figures expected to be 7.1%. When do you think inflation peaks?
Well, you know, that's a great question. It was supposed to have peaked already in the third quarter. Obviously, we're still seeing it climbing. But I think it, you know, clearly a lot of it is, or a big chunk of it is transitory. We don't think we're sticking at 7%. We do have, you know, chip shortages and things of that nature, that used car prices that are driving this. But we think it'll be sticky and maybe in sort of this 3.5% range as it stabilizes because of two key elements that are sticky, which is wages and shelter costs. Both those combined are north of 50% of CPI, and we see very good arguments in both of those areas for inflation to be elevated and sticky for quite a while.
Hey, Cliff, how often does recession come up,
Carol,
in your conversation? Well, Ari Jersey of our Bloomberg team talked about it. I mean, 2023, 2024, how often does that come up in your conversations?
Well, it's always, you know, it's always part of a potential scenario, but we certainly don't see that in 2022 and into 2023. Again, we view it more as a mid-cycle. You know, we don't see necessarily the broad systemic risk yet building in the economy that would cause a recession. Of course, the obvious risk is if inflation is indeed elevated beyond what we would expect, and the Fed does fall behind the curve, that's, you know, a classic recipe for the Fed really slamming the brakes on. But it's a very dovish Fed. We see the term hawkish pivot.
Right.
It's a very dovish Fed.
Yeah. I mean,
something that you say, well, you don't use those terms, Carol, but you just remind us over and over again where interest rates are right now and where they're going to be even in a year. It's really low still.
I mean, they can make four quarter point moves, and we're just, what, up 1%.
Exactly.
So it's still pretty, pretty dovish. Cliff Corso, have a good weekend. Stay safe. President and Chief Investment Officer at Advisor Asset Management, on the phone in New York City.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.